program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State magazine is underwritten by Carter Class Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. In this episode, we will finish our glimpse into the October issue of Our State magazine, which was featuring articles all about North Carolina's mountain area and entitled Mountain Strong, Healing After Helene. Our first article for this episode is The Spirit of Marshall. After the flood, a mountain town and its iconic hotel became symbols of recovery. Since the French Broad River flooded Marshall with 27 feet of water, its residents have rallied to rebuild their town. Josh Copus waded into the old jailhouse by the river and railroad, murky water up to his knees, and figured there was no escaping it. The whole town of Marshall would have to be condemned. "It almost broke me," says a self-styled optimist who in that moment could see no silver lining in the havoc unleashed on his mountain home. A day before, the swollen French Broad River swept over the town's only bridge and surged onto Bailey's Branch Road, onto Main Street, unstoppable beneath the town's two traffic lights. It poured into the coffee shops, the brew house, the bike shop, the hardware store, the post office. It tore through town hall, breaking windows and crumbling bricks, and it flooded the 119-year-old Madison County Jail that Copus had transformed into a boutique hotel, engulfing its ground floor and wiping out the restaurant. "There was nowhere to escape. Everywhere you went in this town, you were faced with the completeness of the destruction," Copus says, and that's a lot to process. Just a week earlier, he was brimming with pride and told a friend, "This is the coolest Marshall has ever been in my lifetime." 30 minutes north of Asheville, this town of cozy hangouts, snug in a river valley, had become a destination. People were coming for locally brewed beer, coffee, and quiche at Zuma Coffee, bluegrass jam sessions, or a night at the old Marshall Jail Hotel, which Copus opened in 2021, excuse me. With a two-day growth of beard, uncombed hair, untucked T-shirt, and well-worn jeans, Copus is a tireless and engaging talker. But he's quick to pause the conversation to greet a friend who happens by, and he has many, with a hearty handshake or hug or what's up. He's sitting at a table in the back room of Zadie's, his restaurant and bar that reopened in May after a GoFundMe campaign bought a deluge of donations. Copus thinks back to those dark hours immediately after the storm. Marshall, home to 800-plus people, appeared lifeless, assaulted by a river with which it long coexisted. "And then an amazing thing happened," Copus says. As the flood water retreated, neighbors treaded onto the muck-slathered streets with wheelbarrows, shovels, skid steers, pickup trucks, and a sense of resolve. One woman, he says, showed up with only a mop, eager to do her small part in the daunting task of cleaning up. "What I saw was that this town is not the stuff. The town is the people," he says. "The people make the place. Our people didn't go anywhere. They just kept showing up every day." With his easy manner and conversation skills, Copus became a natural ambassador for Marshall after the storm's aftermath. He was a popular interview for television reporters, appearing on CNN and newscasts from Charlotte to Chicago. When Copus was interviewed by Good Morning America, he extolled his town's shatterproof spirit. "There's an incredible human story of community coming together," he told the hosts. He provided video tours and commentary on YouTube and TikTok. When then-Governor Roy Cooper and then-Attorney General Josh Stein visited Marshall in Helene's wake, he was sure to greet them and tell Marshall's story, assuring everyone within earshot that it's a town undaunted. "There's no sense in sitting around feeling sorry for yourself, so that's what strengthened my commitment to this town. People came up to me and said, 'You matter. Zadie's matters. The old Marshall Jail matters, and we need you.'" Copus is not a native son of Marshall, but he is a child of Appalachia, having grown up in Floyd County, Virginia. He moved to Asheville in 1998 to attend Warren Wilson College, then enrolled at the University of North Carolina at Asheville to earn a bachelor's degree. He's a potter by trade and keeps wood-fired kilns on his patch of land outside town, where he digs into the hillsides for his own clay. In 2016, with the help of three partners, he bought the old Marshall Jail at auction for less than $100,000. Built in 1905 and decommissioned in 2012, it's the oldest operating jail in North Carolina. After the county replaced it with a new jail, the old jail sat vacant for 4 years and fell into further disrepair. Some locals assumed it would be demolished, but the consensus around town was it should be preserved and possibly made into a museum. Copus Ever, the artist, saw this darkened, cobwebbed brick shell as a blank canvas, a lump of clay awaiting his vision and touch. The building, in essence, became his medium. "I always thought about it as art, and not real estate," he says. He had his skeptics. How could a musty lockup ever become a place of style and charm? He even thought he was crazy. "And I think that's one of the reasons why we pulled it off," he says. "You have to be a little crazy." Over the next 5 years, he molded the jail into a 6-room hotel, restaurant, and bar. And it did become something of a museum, too. Letters from inmates and steno notebooks from the longtime and legendary Sheriff E.Y. Ponder, the last old-time mountain lawman, as Copus says, are framed on the walls. Then came Helene, swelling the French Broad to levels unseen by anyone alive today, reaching 27 feet on the hotel's flood gauge. Devastating as it was, Helene was a powerful rush, inspired a powerful rush of creativity and artistic expression. Over the course of 4 days, 35 regional musicians came together in the stairwell of the old jail to record the Renaissance sessions, the Resonance Sessions, a 35-song labor of love released as a triple vinyl album. Sales of the album support Madison County's music and arts community. There's a rawness, an intimacy in the songs as they capture the building's natural acoustics and the sounds of a town at work. In the album, you can hear dump trucks and generators, and there's this ambient noise of everything that was happening in the town, Copus says. It was good for the town, good for the building. It was kind of a processing opportunity for a lot of the musicians. The hotel and restaurant are going strong again, with guests polishing off shrimp and grits and chicken and waffles, swigging beer and wine and sweet tea, drinking up the expansive view of the, again, tranquil French Broad River. The mud is gone, and the concrete floor has its sheen again. The latte swirled at Zuma Coffee, and the beer foams at Mad Company Brewhouse. It's important for us to tell the world that we're back. Copus says he and his town have come a long way since that moment after the storm, when Copus was brought to his knees in deep water, when all seemed insurmountable. But Copus is nothing if not the eternal optimist, and he'll find the most elusive of silver linings. After watching his town's can-do character shine like a sunburst, Marshall may well be the coolest and strongest it's been in anyone's lifetime. The next article in the Healing After Helene series is The Power of Petals. Neighbors in Swannanoa planted thousands of flowers to help their community envision a more hopeful future after last fall's destructive storm. Beneath the soil in Grovemont Park, less than a mile from the Swannanoa River, which a year ago reared its monstrous head and ravaged entire communities in the Swannanoa Valley, 10,000 bulbs lie sleeping, waiting for spring. Tulips, daffodils, peonies, red, yellow, pink, purple. And come April, they'll all be blooming, a sign of rebirth in a community that has seen so much devastation. Last December, Marco Rosenbrick and a small team of other Swannanoa locals planted the bulbs to bring a sign of hope back to the community following Helene. But the seed of hope was planted much earlier, in the days and weeks following the storm, when the community would gather together in the park to offer aid, share resources, and provide comfort to one another. Because Swannanoa is an unincorporated community, residents didn't have a government to turn to for help after the storm. Instead, they turned to each other. Neighbors in the Grovemont community began showing up at the park every day, offering anything they could share. Grovemont was designed to be an intentional community, so this park area and the adjacent Swannanoa Community Center are a natural hub, says Marianne Rogers, a Swannanoa Community Council member, as she sits in the park's pavilion. So when the storm came, it was just a natural place for neighbors to come. And we had a lot of different people with a lot of different resources and talents that created a care center. Without phones or internet, the park became a place for residents to share what they needed and what they had to offer, like water, generators, and power strips. People kept in touch with their loved ones through a satellite internet connection someone set up. Chefs who lived in the neighborhood grilled all the meat that folks brought them before it spoiled in their homes without power. Volunteers distributed food and clothing to local residents. Musicians and jugglers performed for entertainment, and a doctor and a nurse helped anyone with a medical need. Rosenbreck and Rogers chipped in as well. Rosenbreck joined a team of neighbors with chainsaws who cleared trees from roads and properties. And when he and Roger's husband, Justice, found goats wandering around the neighborhood, they located the owners through Facebook. Rogers used her experience in social work and community engagement to help organize altruistic efforts. When other social workers showed up who had experience working with children, Rogers instructed them to set up a kids' area with games, activities, and coloring books. A friend of hers, an equine therapist, brought horses to help people deal with the trauma from the storm. The park offered more than just necessities. One woman showed up and wanted to know how she could help. Rogers told her to set up a chair and just listen to the stories people shared about the storm. Rogers shared her own stories as well. When she left to visit friends in other communities or fetch water from Black Mountain's Pisgah Brewing Company, she'd pass the Swannanoa River full of cars, trash, and even buildings. I would come back and sit in that grove with kids who were drawing, making puppets, and just making things, she said. There might be somebody playing guitar, and it was really grounding and really settling to have come from seeing the immense destruction to then being with people who were just in that moment. As weeks turned to months after the storm, residents returned to their homes, and the park became a place to swing, walk, and enjoy nature once again. But there was at least one lasting change for the better. Neighbors who formerly had never known each other were now dear friends, and Rosenbreck, who'd moved to the community 7 years ago, felt more a part of Swannanoa than ever before. For me, one of the foundations of life is connection, unity. But that's how I grew up, he says. I came from a very small village where you knew almost everyone. And over here, initially, we didn't know that many people. It's very essential for happiness in life, at least for me. Rosenbreck wanted to bring beauty back to his adopted home, so he turned to what he knows best, tulips. Rosenbreck grew up in the town of Anna Palona in North Holland, a province in the Netherlands known for growing tulips and other bulbs. His father grew tulips and created many new varieties that are popular today, like Greenwave Parrot and Parrot King. I see myself as a young 4 or 5 year old boy walking through the tulips at that moment, not realizing what it really meant to me, he says. Tulips are in my heart. After working on his father's tulip farm, Rosenbreck became a flower trader, selling flowers to supermarkets all over Europe and the United States. His wife, Martine van Velden, also from the Netherlands, moved to the United States in 1996 for her job as a floral designer before they were married. In 2009, Rosenbreck moved to the U.S. to start a floral company with her. While living in Miami, they visited Western North Carolina in September 2017. They fell in love with the beauty and the climate, and they were reminded of home. They moved to Swannanoa shortly thereafter. Several years ago, Rosenbreck planted a small tulip farm, and he and his wife began focusing on bulb production. Following Helene, Rosenbreck reached out to Dutch Groen, a flower bulb grower and exporter from the Netherlands, to ask if the company could donate a few boxes of bulbs to plant in the park. He was shocked when 10,000 tulip, daffodil, grape hyacinth, peony, and alimium bulbs showed up at his house in December. The boxes took up about a fourth of the couple's two-car garage, but not for long. He organized a small group of locals to plant the bulbs before the frost. Other than turning the soil with a tiller, the group planted all of the bulbs by hand using nutrient-rich soil the flood waters had deposited in the ditches around the park and lining the flower beds with rocks pitched from the river during the storm. By the second week of April, the flowers were in full bloom. Rosenbreck's efforts with the Grovemont Park's new flowers inspired Rogers to start a garden club, and the members planned to plant more bulbs and some native flowers around the park. Their work has already started along the Swannanoa River. Like Rogers, Rosenbreck is inspired as well, and he'll continue to be involved. Swannanoa is now known for the storm, he says, but we want to be known, hopefully, one day for the flowers. All right, A Path Forward. A Saluda native uses the experience and equipment from his grading business to help his neighbors clear their land, shore up what remains, and find closure, all free of charge. I meet Jake Jarvis of Precision Grading on day 265. Jarvis numbers the days in his Facebook posts, which he uses to chronicle the all-volunteer work he and his crew have been doing since Helene struck last September. For the most part, he's worked 7 days a week, sun up to sundown. He tried to call a friend out on Highway 9, NC Highway 9, he tells me, in the days right after the storm. The friend didn't answer, so Jarvis crewed up one of his trucks and started down toward Bat Cave on U.S. Highway 64. The enormity of the destruction revealed itself slowly. I remember tearing up and telling my guys to get out and get to work, Jarvis says. It took hours to cut the tree and utility poles away from the road. His friend was okay, but it would take another 2 weeks to reach him. At the bottom, Jarvis tells me, Bat Cave was an island. The bridges were washed out. The fire chief said the roads were gone. People were in trouble. I told him I'd build him a road and get him side-by-side access by the end of the day. A side-by-side, I clarify, is a four-wheeler, a UTV. They needed a way for emergency vehicles to reach people trapped and injured by flooding, by mudslides. Jarvis and his crew built the road, built so many roads in the coming days, often in part using the foundations of buildings that were gone. Precision Grading has been there, give or take, ever since. I came to know of precision grading in the weeks after Helene, when we'd gone to Asheville to evacuate my mother-in-law back to Greensboro. News was spotty. I had crowdsourced a safe route in and out of Asheville and was now deep diving social media for reliable local information about when and how the area might get power and water back. I don't know if Jarvis's October 15th post was the first one I saw, but it is the one where he says for the first time that he would be willing to accept donations. He'd been going house to house, helping people one project at a time, free of charge. It was costing $3,500 a day, now $4,500 per day, just to run and repair the equipment, excavators, bulldozers, and dump trucks, and to pay the crew. At first, Jarvis was running about half on private donation and half of his own funds. He took a private job 6 weeks in just to make ends meet, but he knew he'd come back to his community. I'm not really worried about me, he says when asked whether he was able to pay himself a salary, but I knew I couldn't leave people sitting like they were and I couldn't charge them. It was the volunteer aspect that kept me coming back to the Precision Grading post day after day, that and the photographs. So many bridges, so many driveways, so many homes. In Green River Cove alone, some 30 homes were washed away or destroyed. Jarvis worked with the riverkeeper there to remove vehicles and septic tanks from the water and put the river back where it was supposed to be. It's a sentence that doesn't make sense. Neither does stopping your life to rebuild communities one boulder at a time unless you're able, and so that's what Jarvis has been doing. There are donation options and a post pinned to the top of Precision Grading Facebook page. There's a help list that remains more than 100 people long. People keep coming back onto the list, too, because it keeps raining, hillsides washing away, again, because they're so little stable yet. Jarvis has a servant's heart. He stands with me on the side of the road in Batcave, activity buzzing around us. There's so much to do. He'll be working in the driveway at one job, and a neighbor will walk up and find a way to ask if maybe Jarvis could help them too. There are signs reading, "Thank you, Precision Grading," hanging off riverside homes he saved by rebuilding the riverbank and the bridge across, showing up foundations. "How long do you think you'll have to go?" I ask him. He sighs, and I can see the stress in his shoulders. "I don't know if we're halfway yet." The job Precision Grading is working on today, day 265, is demolishing a medical center and grading smooth the lot it once stood on. 60 loads of dirt from this parcel got trucked down the road to fill in land lost at a rebuilt home. Jarvis and his crew are also finishing a camp for a group of traveling Amish and helping Spokes of Hope, a disaster response and relief agency, coordinate volunteers. Shannon Brookshire, who volunteers at Precision Grading, is also the treasurer for the Saluda Pantry. "It's so much about logistics," she tells me before apologizing and taking a call. "Someone's donating lubricant for the heavy equipment. A donor in Virginia sent 100 bridge beams." Brookshire's accent suggests that unlike Jarvis, who's lived in Saluda all his life, save for a stint in the Air Force, he enlisted after 9/11. She's not originally from there. "Michigan," she says, "but after this, I'll never leave." We're down on a temporary gravel road in a scoured riverbed that now feels more like a canyon. I've learned how important it is to be around people you can rely on. "I've never been around such amazing people," she says. I ask how she met Jarvis, how she came to work for him. "Oh," she says, and makes a gesture everything. This, she says. Maya, Jarvis's 9-year-old daughter, had been asleep in the cab of the dump truck. She now walks over, yawning. "Jarvis is a single father. Maya's on emotional support duty," he told me earlier. "People find it helps having her around. She comes to the work sites with him after school during the year, and they brought a camper to Batcave for the summer and weekends. The drive back to Saluda each day had taken a toll." It's so hard, he says, of the people watching their homes get taken down. "Took their whole lives to build this. Takes us 10 minutes and their house is in a pile. Almost nobody had flood insurance." Having Maya there, Jarvis says, seems to ease the burden. I get down on one knee. Maya's got a seriousness about her, but also an openness and maybe something like hope. She's a kid. Maybe she sees these coves and hollers the way her dad does, as places that are hurting and could use her help. "What's the best part?" I start to ask her, but the question's wrong. She knows what I mean, though, somehow. "Hanging out with him," she said, meaning her dad. "What do you tell people?" I ask her. "That they'll get another house, maybe a better one," she says. She gives a small smile. You know, positive stuff. Precision Grading's post for day 265 and 266 describes the work at the medical center, then notes, "In Chimney Rock, we focused on saving the foundation of the burnt shirt building on Main Street. It was looking more and more vulnerable every day, and I just decided I couldn't watch and not act on that property any longer. I took my entire team down there. I think it's my fascination with these posts and with Precision's work. Jarvis and his crew cannot watch and not act." Early in the storm recovery, one of the posts noticed that Precision Grading was the only crew down here. They're very much not now, but Batcave and Chimney Rock were crawling with contractors and volunteers the day I visited. But Jarvis has been there from the beginning. One friend didn't pick up the phone, but entire communities were crying out. Jake Jarvis and his crew had the skills, the equipment, and the heart to help. And with the time we have left, I'll do a couple of the regular columns. Our State Supper Club. Win and dine. No matter what happens inside the stadium, there are no losers at this tailgate. It's a short drive from Todd to Boone for a Saturday of Appalachian football, and the car was packed with all the essentials, friends, food, and a pup that was just as excited as we were. I'd driven up to see my college roommate, who met her husband at App State and is now retired to Todd. As we rounded the curvy roads and hairpin turns, I spotted the bell tower and could hear the rumble of the band's warm-up as it echoed through the mountain ridge. Down the hill from campus, we entered a parking lot off King Street and spotted 20 or so fans huddling around mobile fire pits with beers in hand. Once parked, we unloaded the grill and folding chairs and set up the truck bed in sections, serveware on one side, side dishes and desserts on the other. The lowered tailgate made a perfect counter for my cutting board and prep station. In the spaces around us, I saw crock pots full of chili and cheese dip, plenty of vegetable trays that most likely went uneaten. I've often preferred these smaller, more intimate tailgate celebrations compared to the larger university gatherings. Here we could all sit by the fire or grill with the dog curled up close and tell the same stories of our college years while listening to the game on the radio. For me, it's not about who emerges victorious. Tailgating is being together with friends, our cheeks pink from the crisp air and the wafts of fried foods and wood-smoked pork mixed with sweetness from homemade desserts. Now that's a win. Another new column is entitled Above and Beyond, Celebrating North Carolina from New Heights. And this is about Crowder's Mountain State Park. The rewards for the 2-mile climb up Pinnacle Trail in Gaston County are a spectacular vista and a moment of quiet reflection. With perfect timing, hikers can see the setting sun cast its glow across the autumn landscape. And we have someone who's done just that, hiked up there and is seated on the rock, and the setting sun is casting its glow across the autumn landscape. Pretty colors on the trees at that point. And another regular column is Welcome to Our State. Brinegar Cabin in Doughton Park, Trap Hill. When it was built in 1889, this 1.5-story log cabin was part of an expansive 125-acre farmstead. Livestock roamed free, apples hung heavy, and crops like buckwheat, rye, oats, corn, and sorghum thrived under the care of Martin and Caroline Brinegar. A cobbler and a weaver, the resourceful pair carved out a life for their family on this hill, and their cabin witnessed both hardships and delights. Today it preserves construction techniques and materials that were commonly used by early settlers in remote areas of North Carolina: wooden clapboard siding, wooden shingles, and 2 dry-stacked chimneys on a full stone foundation. The property was added to the National Register of Historic Places in 1972. Part of Doughton Park, the cabin, along with Brinegar's granary and springhouse, an interpretive garden, and more, provides visitors a peek into the life of a 19th-century Appalachian farming family, as well as a peaceful moment of reflection. The Brinegars may be gone, but their home still stands as a monument to an indomitable mountain spirit. It's located at milepost 238.5 on the Blue Ridge Parkway at Trap Hill, North Carolina. That sounds mean as we've run out of time for this week's edition of Our State Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of the program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. For any questions or comments, call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.